Good morning.
Morning. Hi.
Okay, so what we're going to do today is first we're going to finish off what we were talking about last week. I'll quickly summarize for people who weren't here and even for those of us who were. And the issues are connected enough thematically that it's important to go over the basics. So, again, the theme for the series that we'd set up were we were going to analyze three different cases, hopefully three, where human beings seem to be acting like God. And what we wanted to analyze was to what extent does the Jewish tradition endorse people acting like God, and to what extent do we think that that is going beyond the expectations and responsibilities of mankind, and we're supposed to, at some level, pull back when we become too godlike. So the first case that we used to test it last week was the question of choosing the gender of your child. We noted that scientifically there are different ways of doing it. There's the sort of at-home methods, which aren't that successful. They raise the rate of success in choosing your gender from 50%, which is determined by chance, to about 56%. Then there's the Erickson method, which uses when you use artificial insemination, which has about a 73 to 85% success rate. And then there's the cases with IVF, which has 100%, but also is extremely expensive, costing about $20,000 a round. So what we wanted to do was deal with the sort of the philosophical and legal issues involved. And what we basically set up last week, just to summarize, was first, we noted that there seems to be a dispute regarding the mitzvah of shatnez, of all the different interbreedings and intermatings, about whether this is just a law without a reason, or the Ramban, Nachmanides, introduces the possibility that perhaps the reason we can't crossbreed animals to create a new breed is because God doesn't want us to act like God. And He creates, we don't create. And some people pointed to that Ramban, to that passage in Nachmanides, to argue that we shouldn't choose the gender of our children because you see there's a problem with acting like God. I noted at the time there are some who push back and say that even if there's a problem with acting like God, based on this passage in Nachmanides, choosing the gender of your child, or what we'll see today, cloning, doesn't really fit that bill, because it could be that the reason it's acting like God when you crossbreed is because you're creating a new creation. But when you're choosing the gender of your child, or even cloning a human being, you're just manipulating the reproductive process of human beings, but you're not creating a new being, so maybe even Nachmanides would not think this is a problem. If you look at today's sources, I just gave you an example of someone who said that. He says in the context of cloning, so I left it for this week, but we'd already brought up the conceptual issue this week. That's the first source here. This is from Dr. Avram Steinberg, the author of the Encyclopedia of Jewish Medical Ethics. An article he wrote in a symposium in the Torah Mada Journal, Volume 9, where he writes as follows: although fundamentally involvement with creation is permissible, three compelling conditions must be satisfied if such involvement is to be justified. One, there is no essential halachic prohibition in the actual actions of technological advancement. Two, the process of improvement of creation does not have a prohibited result, which cannot be prevented or corrected. Three, the act of improvement benefits humans, and moreover, the derived benefit surpasses the detriment. This notion can be found worded in many ways by the great halakhic masters. There are those who explain the prohibition of witchcraft, crossbreeding, and even shatnez as a transformation in the order of creation, but cloning humans through technology is a natural act which does not introduce a totally unfamiliar species into nature, and thus differs from both witchcraft and interbreeding. In this respect, human cloning, and again, to our issue last week, choosing the gender of your child is no different from the using of antibiotics to decimate injurious bacteria. So we noted this last week. Again, there's this dispute. Is there a problem to act like God? And even if there is choosing the gender of your child or cloning, is that considered too godlike? Or is the prohibition only to create new creatures in this world and not manipulate the act of procreation? And we noted that there were those who argued that there are specific problems with acting like God in the area of procreation, the Gemara in Brachot, this was source 8, that the king Chizkiah almost died because he didn't want to have children, because he foresaw through prophecy that his children would be evil, and the prophet Isaiah told him that that's not your business, you have to have children, let God deal with the rest, and he wasn't supposed to try to manipulate who he was going to have. We also noted that at the other extreme, there was the Meiri, or Menachem Meiri, in 13th century Provence, who said explicitly 700 years ago that anything that's done through natural means is not considered witchcraft, even if we'll become known how to create beautiful creatures without mating, who 700 years before this was an issue seemed to have seen cloning coming and said it wasn't a problem because he said, no, explicitly that is not a problem. Yeah, Loretta.
I want to backtrack to Dr. Avraham Steinberg, if I may.
Sure.
First of all, when was this done? This is very, very recent.
This is very recently. This is 2007.
In the last 10 years.
Yeah, so 2007, 2009.
Dr. Avraham Steinberg is a medical doctor?
Yes, he is a medical doctor.
He is a medical doctor who wrote in Torah Madab.
He's a rabbi and a medical doctor.
Yeah, he's at Shari
Tzedek.
He's at Shari Tzedek in Israel. Yeah. Shari Tzedek Hospital in Israel.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, that's good to know.
Yeah, he's the, I forget what, I think he's in internal medicine.
He does, Pascal Shiloh.
Yes, yes, he's both a doctor and a post-sick, yeah.
He's at Shari Tzedek, he's a medical ethicist.
Yeah. A very prominent medical ethicist in Israel, and I mean his stuff is almost all translated into English as well.
Okay, thank you. I'm glad I went back to ask. That's very interesting.
Okay, so just a few points on last week before we see how people actually rule on the issue. In addition to the sort of philosophical issues that we dealt with, there are some local issues that come up with the process of actually choosing gender. So again, as we noted, there were three different techniques. We noted that according to almost all authorities, the first ones, right, changing your diet, changing positions during intercourse and the like, are not problematic, as the Talmud itself seems to have been aware that that was possible. But the other two, the Erickson method and the method of IVF, do create ancillary problems, specifically, in both of them really, since the man will need to have his sperm not in his body, right? He needs to get it out, which is a problem because there's a general prohibition of masturbation and destroying seed, and here, right, besides the problem of getting it out, you have to destroy most of it, or most of it will go to no use because you're taking a few and you're using them, but the rest of it won't be used. So there are these ancillary problems. So there are those. Yes.
May I ask another question?
Sure.
I don't have last week's source sheet in front of me now, but you have quoted Onan. I mean, you as one of the sources.
Yes.
I was under the impression that Onan, who spilled his seed, was condemned because he didn't want to raise up his brother's name.
Right. So
and
the
it wasn't just the question of spilling seed, but it was because he refused to do.
So in the story in the Chumash, it's open whether his primary sin was. Well, remember, both Er and Onan are killed, right? Both brothers, right? Judah has three sons. Er is the first one. He is married and he does something. He sins. We don't know what he does, and he gets killed for it. God kills him. Then his brother marries the wife of Er, and doesn't want to, through the levirate marriage, and doesn't want to have children with Tamar, who will be, you know, the sort of the spiritual children of Er, of his brother, so he then spills his seed. The Talmud, based on comparing Er and Onan, assumes that Er, the first brother, was guilty of the same sin as Onan. Now, he doesn't have any you know, and he doesn't have any outside reasons for not wanting to have children. He just was spilling his seed. So based on the fact that Er and Onan, both of them are punished for seemingly at least to some level the same reason, the Talmud, and this is in source 13, assumes that at least Er's sin was entirely the fact that he spilled his seed. Right, because he's the first brother. He doesn't yet have another reason to spill a seed besides the fact that he just doesn't want to have children. Right, so from that, the Talmud derives a general prohibition against emitting semen in vain. Right, and that's the Talmud. Right, so Onan has two parts to it. Right, he's spilling seed and he's trying not to raise up the name of his brother by having children with his former wife. But Er, the first brother, his only sin is that he spilled his seed. Right, so I think that's part of the basis of the Talmud's prohibition. That's one of the sort of side concerns. Now, while it's true that for let's say issues of infertility testing, most halachic authorities are lenient, and they say that's not considered wasting seed because it's necessary to test to see is there potent sperm within the semen or not, and that's necessary for procreation, right? If one hasn't had children for a while and needs to go through the testing process, so most authorities will permit that. And also, when one cannot have children and needs to do this in order to procreate through IVF, most authorities will permit it. Some authorities were hesitant to do it in the case of gender choosing, because since you're just trying to choose gender, you don't need to have children not through the sexual act. You could have children through the sexual act. You're using the artificial insemination or the IVF simply to choose gender. So some authorities said that's not enough of a reason to justify emitting sperm not through the sexual act, and therefore thought that it would be prohibited, not for these sort of, you know, philosophical reasons of playing God, but because you're doing something wrong in the process. So, for example, in 14, for people who have last week's, for Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, I'll just read it. He just says that this is actually my summary, so it's not even a quote, because it's a long piece, where he just says that for non-medical purposes, and he considers this non-medical, sperm washing would be considered destroying seed, and therefore he opposes choosing of gender with artificial insemination or IVF, which both require a level of sperm washing, because it destroys seed for reasons that he considers illegitimate. Another possible problem, which in the end we don't tend to think is a problem, is the problem of abortion, right? Is it a problem of abortion when you destroy the other zygotes in the IVF process? Because you're only going to take one or two of them and implant them in the woman, but what about all the others that you created? You usually create more. And there, while at first glance that might be a problem, most authorities think it's not, because the Talmud's assumption, based on the Gemara in Yevamot, is that until the 40 days after conception, the zygote has no legal significance. It's considered mere water. And in fact, this is what we know based on science, right? Within the first 6 weeks, about a third of all pregnancies will end in a miscarriage, and often people won't even notice it. Right? Scientifically, we know this, that there's that point, right? 6 weeks is approximately that 40 days before which the chances of survival are not that great, because the pregnancy isn't that advanced, which seems to work scientifically with the assumption of the rabbis of the Talmud. Okay, so with that background now, how do authorities actually weigh in on the issue? So if you have from last week, I put a summary here. So the way this came up in Israel was there's an organization called Machon Pua. Have you ever heard of Machon Pua? So Machon Pua is an organization, the Pua Institute, which is devoted to helping Jews with procreation issues in Israel. Mostly people with infertility, but at some point a lot of people were coming to them not with infertility issues, but were coming to them with the question of, can we choose the gender of our child? We have four boys and we want a girl. We have four girls and we want a boy. Can you help us with that, even though we don't have fertility problems, but we have a problem in the area of fertility? Can you help? So Rav Menachem Borstein, who's the head of the Pua Institute, posed the question, can you choose the gender of your child, to a number of leading rabbis in Israel? Now, it's hard to actually find these. Rabbi Kenneth Brander at YU very helpfully provided online, and I can send out the link to anyone who wants on the email list, but it's hard to read. All these rabbis apparently didn't have that much time to write full responses, so what they did was they, on the sheet that Rav Borstein sent them, the letter that he sent, they scribbled in their responses on the side. So you actually just have to read sort of their scribbles on the side of it to see the responses. So I did do the favor here of just summarizing what they said. In one case, I actually quoted it. So if you look at this list, Rav Yehoshua Neuwirth, who was a leading authority who died about 2 years ago, wrote a critical work on the laws of Shabbat. He opposes the entire thing, and he says, "It pains me that you are dealing with hidden things," borrowing from the passage in Brachot that we saw, where the king Chizkiah was critiqued by the prophet for even trying to avoid having children because he knew his children would be evil, and the prophet had said to him, "Why are you dealing with God's hidden things? It's not your business. Just you do your job, and how your children turn out, leave it to God." So he says, "It pains me that you're dealing with hidden things. You should help people with marital issues, not things like these. We do our part and leave the rest up to God." So Rav Yehoshua Neuwirth takes the sort of extreme position and said, "This is an imposition onto God's will, and therefore I oppose it under all circumstances, even when all you're doing is changing your diet or changing positions or trying to time intercourse to ovulation. Even there, the very fact that you're trying to act like God and get involved in God's affairs is itself problematic, and he forbids all of it." Most of the authorities, though, disagreed and said all the natural methods are fine. Okay, so you're working within the natural methods, you're changing your diet, you're changing position, you're timing ovulation and intercourse, that's fine. That's not too much like acting like God. But they didn't like the other two, the artificial insemination or IVF, because they felt that it acted too much like being like God. Shlomo Amar felt this way, and he said that method one was fine, the natural ones were fine, but the other two are problematic because you're acting like God. But he put in a caveat that he would allow them for certain reasons. So if, for example, there were health reasons, as we mentioned last week, certain diseases only go along the Y chromosome. So therefore you say, "I only want girls, not because I want to act like God, because I want to protect the child." So then he thought that it was permitted. He thought it was also permitted if you only had boys or only had girls and wanted one of the other gender, because the commandment of procreation requires having a boy and a girl, and therefore he thought that was sufficient reason. And he even thought that if it was going to cause extreme discord within the family, one of the spouses really just, it's too much of a boy's house, we need a girl here, right? We have four boys, five boys, and we need a girl. He was even willing to consider there. So basically his position was, all things being equal, we don't like you acting like God, but if there's a compelling reason that makes it that you're not just doing this to be God, but you're doing it because there's a reason, like a pragmatic reason that you need to do it, or a halachic reason that you need to do it, then he was more willing to accept it. Rav Meir Mazuz was even more restrictive and thought that you could only use the artificial insemination, IVF methods, for health reasons, but for everything else, he thought it was too much acting like God. Okay. There is a totally another dimension to this, which we alluded to last week, which is beyond the issue of acting like God and beyond the technical issues of destroying seed and the like. We noted that there's also the problem of the slippery slope towards eugenics. Right? That even if you think you should be allowed to choose gender, because gender is a, makes sense, you have a few boys, you want a girl, or vice versa, who knows where it'll lead? Once you allow people to start choosing the gender of their child, right, they might also want to choose the eye color of their child or the intelligence of their child, and it's a very slippery slope towards eugenics. For that reason, we mentioned that certain legal systems are extremely harsh and oppose the choosing of gender, even more than they oppose selective abortion. Specifically Canada. And this was the Assisted Human Reproduction Act in Source 16. You can read it inside, but the law in Canada, if you choose the gender of your child in IVF or in artificial insemination, you have a penalty of up to $500,000 and 10 years in prison. This is despite the fact that you are allowed to selectively abort in Canada, right? You're allowed to, do screening once you're already pregnant, see that the child is a male and you want a female, and abort the child. That's legal. But if you choose through IVF, 10 years in prison, $500,000 fine.
Sorry. That's not correct.
What? That's not correct. That is. It is.
What are you saying?
Human Reproduction Act of 2004.
The screening is not, you can have the abortion, but you can't have the screening. That's Catch-22.
But if you do a screening for another reason, you'll be able to figure it out, and then you can do the abortion. Okay, I believe I saw a doctor claim that wasn't true last year, because you could do a screening for other reasons. You can say you're doing it for medical reasons,
right?
And then find out the gender and then selectively abort.
Correct, but they're not supposed to tell you the gender if they do it for the medical reasons.
When I did the research, it seemed like that wasn't the case. But if that's the case, then it would be more, but I at least saw one article by a doctor claiming that wasn't at least the reality on the ground, was that people did selectively abort in Canada without penalty. And this was an op-ed last year, and I think in the
reality on the ground is not the law.
Okay. Now, one of the reasons, though, that choosing gender through IVF is so strict is because of this slippery slope problem, is the slippery slope towards eugenics. So therefore, countries like Canada really do take a very strict position. Now, in Israel, is often the case, when they're setting public policy, they ask rabbis for their input, not only rabbis, but they also ask rabbis for a Torah perspective when they're trying to form public policy. So one of the people they asked was a Rabbi Yuval Shurlo, current rabbi he used to be in Petah Tikva, now he moved to Ranana, whether they should prohibit gender choosing because of this slippery slope argument, the slippery slope towards eugenics. So he argued that if you take all of Jewish law together, based on all the limits that we put on the setting up of decrees, which is essentially what this is, right? If you assume that choosing the gender is not intrinsically wrong, but has a slippery slope towards eugenics, so the question you're really asking is, under what circumstances is it right to set up protective measures? Yes? Right? So he says that there are basically three factors you have to consider when you set up a decree to prevent a slippery slope. The first, he said, is how likely is this undesired result, right? How likely is it that it's going to happen? Meaning, in this case, how likely is it that we'll go from gender choosing to eugenics? So that's the first question you have to ask. And he bases this on the fact that that the rabbis say that they only set up decrees to prevent common issues, right? But if something happens one in a million cases, they won't bother decreeing it. Right, there's a rule in the Talmud Milta, the Lo Shchicha Lo Gazru Bei Rabbanan. If something doesn't happen often, then we don't set up a decree against it, because we only set up sort of overarching decrees, protective measures, if the undesired result is going to happen, is likely to happen. If it's not likely to happen, so okay, one person will engage in eugenics. Okay, that's not worth forbidding everybody from gender choosing if you think that gender choosing is not intrinsically wrong. You have a question?
No, sorry to put the question. It's a mathematical formula. You, in a country of 10 million people, you might only need 5,000 females, because maybe there are enough sperm to impregnate with the idea that those 90% enough sperm to impregnate one, and then to engineer to have a nation of almost only males.
It's true, but what's the likely
army to attack a stronger males to attack the enemies?
Right, but the question is always, what's the likelihood of creating a reality like that?
30 years from now, it's very likely.
Well, I don't know if it's very likely, because, right, I mean, yes, China has this problem, but is it, I don't think it's, 90-10, right? It's still, what is it, it's like a 70-30 split.
How many sperm is in each male?
I mean, it's constantly recreated, so it's not a, but,
to
Okay, well, okay, well,
could make a million
okay.
babies. That's the point I'm making.
Yeah, but not the but you still need the anyway, you still need women to actually bear the children. So, I don't anyways, this is the problem. Well, okay, well, we'll leave this on the side for now. So Rav Shurlo argues that when deciding whether to ban things based on the slippery slope, the first thing you have to figure out is how likely is it that the undesired result, in this case eugenics, or a society of only males or only females, is to occur. The second is how negative do you think the result is? In this case, possibly really bad. But he just notes that you have to weigh that, and he says that if you look in the Talmud says that we don't set up to decrees to decrees, because, you know, and the reason he says, why don't we set up decrees to decrees? Meaning, why don't we set up rabbinic laws to protect rabbinic laws? Because we set up rabbinic laws to prevent the violation of biblical laws, because that's really bad. But the violation of rabbinic laws is less bad. So while we don't want it to happen, we're not going to set up a decree to protect a decree because the result isn't that bad. So you see that one of the things you have to take into account is how bad you think the result is. Now, he doesn't answer how bad he thinks the result is. He just says these are the ways you have to think about it. And the third, he says, is that there are exceptions to rabbinic decrees in cases of extreme loss, from which he derives that we don't set up slippery slope decrees when the cost in quality to the people actually affected by the decree is too great. So in the case of gender choosing, he says, how much pain will it actually cause these parents if they can't choose the gender of the children? So again, these are the three questions he says you need to ask. Right? How bad is the result, right? What could happen, and how likely is it that there will be eugenics or a totally male or totally female society? Two is, how bad is it if that happens? And three is, what is the cost to the parents who can't choose the gender of their child? He doesn't answer those questions. He just said those are the three axes that you have to think about when you're setting up the decree. The last thing I want to read you before we move to cloning is a summary of the law in Israel, which you'll see attempts to, in fact, balance all of the issues that we've talked about. The cost to life, the danger, the exceptions for medical issues, for mitzvot, for the commandment of procreation. All of those, right? Every concern that we raised ended up being integrated into the Israeli law. So this is a summary. Israel has a unique approach to the question. Israel is known for its high rates of IVF, with the highest rates of intervention per capita in the world. PGD, and this is the screening, is regulated by the Ministry of Health since 2005, based not on legislation, but mandated by directive. And sex selection for non-medical reasons is basically prohibited. Exceptions can be made in rare cases after written permission is granted by the committee, appointed by the Director General of the Ministry of Health and composed of 7 members, including a psychologist, physicians in OBGYN and genetics, a medical ethicist, social worker, lawyer, and clergyman. Couples and single women can apply if they feel there would be significant damage to the family members' mental health if the procedure was not done. The applicants should be married and have 4 joint children of same sex and none of the other. They must undergo genetic counseling about the PGD process and give written consent. The applicants must understand if embryos of the non-selected sex remain, no additional IVF cycles can be done until all remaining embryos are used by the couple. In addition, specific and idiosyncratic religious reasons were considered, as we mentioned last week, as in the case of priestly Jewish families. For people who weren't here, there was a case in Israel of a couple where the husband was a Kohen, was a priest, and therefore didn't, when he was found to be impotent and his wife had to use donor sperm, he only wanted girls, because if he had a boy, his child would not be a Kohen, would not be a priest, and everyone, when you go to shul, when you go to synagogue, would realize his son is not really his son. So he only wanted girls, so no one would ever know that the child was not his. So that's taken into account. Requiring a sperm donor where a son who is not of genetic lineage could possibly bless the congregation, those girls would be preferred. Also included in the application was whether IVF was necessary to achieve a pregnancy in any event. The procedure was not funded by the government, unlike the liberal IVF coverage for infertility in Israel. So Israel, in the end, the law balances many of the things that we said. They don't ban it outright. Right? For medical reasons, they permit it. For non-medical reasons, they limit it. They try to put, right, they don't try to ban it entirely, but they put limitations. If there's a reason for procreation, for the case of the Kohen, for mental health of the family, they'll consider it, right? In order to prevent the problem of the slippery slope, right, they right? Put all these limitations. There's this panel that has to review it. They also will only let you do the process, right, if on one IVF cycle, right, they won't let you keep doing IVF cycles until you find a girl or until you find a boy. They'll let you do one IVF cycle and start with the boys or start with the girls, but if, you know, that pregnancy doesn't work and you have to use the other zygotes that were created, so then you have to finish that IVF cycle. We're not going to let you, right, be so obsessed with the eugenic aspect that we're going to keep doing IVF cycles until you find the right zygote, right? That would already border on eugenics. If you already have to do IVF for medical reasons, so there's less of a concern that this will lead to general eugenics because you're doing IVF anyways, so all you're doing now is doing extra screening, then they're more lenient, right? So what you see is that the Israeli law attempts to balance, on the one hand, not an absolute prohibition, but with a recognition of the potential problems, the slippery slope issues, and moral problems, and create some sort of middle ground that balances sort of all the factors that we've seen. Okay, so that is the basic summary of the issue as it stands, both in halakha and in law, both in Canada and in Israel, of gender choosing. Any questions before we move to cloning? Okay. Okay, so we mentioned last week that the basic philosophical question of, you know, can you act like God, or is this considered acting too much like God, is the same for gender choosing and for cloning. And we've dealt with it. Again, just to, right, we summarized it half an hour ago, but just to summarize it again, there are those who think there's no problem of engaging in the scientific process, even to create human beings, because we're meant to master the world, and therefore this is totally permitted. There are those who think, based on Ramban, that no, you can't act like God. And there are those who we saw, this was the first source on the sheet, who think that even cloning is not acting like God, because all you're doing is messing with human procreation, but you're not creating an uber-human, you're just creating human beings. So now what do we mean by cloning? So cloning, the way it, for the most part, is done, at least at this point in science, when we clone, let's say, animals, is that you take an egg, you clear out the genetic data, and you insert the genetic data of whoever it is you want to clone, right? And then you reinsert the egg into a woman, and then the child born will be genetically identical to the DNA donor, right? That's what we mean by cloning, right? Now, it can be done by a male, it can be done by a female, right? You're right inside the egg, right? There's the part of it which is there's the sort of physical structure of the egg. You're taking the genetic code,
right,
of a human being or whatever that already exists,
right.
And so for example, right, like Dolly, right, that was the first case of the cloned sheep, right? That's what you did. Now at this,
to be identical to the original.
Exactly, it would be identical to the parent, the DNA, right, to the DNA parent.
Yeah.
Correct. And therefore, at least at this stage in history, right, we are not at the point where we can circumvent the reproductive process. Right? All we're doing is messing with the right, this is part of Dr. Steinberg's argument, is that all we're doing is messing with the reproductive process, because in the end of the day, we haven't yet figured out how to create a human being without an egg, without a woman to actually bear the child, right, and without genetic, and without, you know, sort of the normal physical. What? Yeah, meaning we can, what's open right now in science, and we're not entirely clear about, is that it seems to be that human beings, in addition to our genetic makeup, the physical structure of the egg, the mitochondria in the egg itself, seems to have some effect on how we turn out, but we're not sure exactly how. So it seems to be that the child won't be exactly identical, because there's some differences, but we're not sure what those are, and they're very minuscule, or at least that the current scientific thinking is that we think they're minimal. We don't really know. But again, yes, just to clarify the process we're talking about, right? So cloning of human beings, what we're talking about, at least at this stage in scientific history, is taking an egg, cleaning out the basic genetic data, the code, putting in the genetic data of an existing human being, then re-implanting the egg into a surrogate mother, right? Even either the mother that we took the egg out of or in somebody else, and then the child being born will be basically the genetic equivalent, the identical twin, as it were, of the DNA parent, right? That's cloning. What? So, why would people do that? There are all types of nefarious reasons why people might do it, which is one of the concerns that people have. But one of the reasons, let's say the good reasons that people would do it, are the two that really come up. Is one is if someone cannot has no sperm, right? If a male wants to procreate, right, wants to feel like he's involved in the process of procreation, but has no sperm, then this is a way for him to continue his genetic legacy, right? Because he can, instead of, right, impregnating his wife with his sperm, he can impregnate his wife with himself, right? That's one. Correct, but we can do that, right? We have the science to do that, right?
It would still have to be a fertilized.
But this is essentially fertilizing it, right? Meaning we're creating the mechanisms, and we have all types of ways we can actually, well, for human beings, no. It is highly illegal in most countries at the moment. Though in some countries, not yet illegal. But we haven't figured it out yet because it's too dangerous. Because of, you know, the more pressing reason for most people, this doesn't come up so much, but the pressing reason is that and this is not for an adult, but this comes up, I mean, whatever, it could be for an adult, but this has come up also with children, is that a clone would be your best organ donor, or bone marrow donor, or blood donor, because it would be your blood, or your, right, with your genetic makeup. So one of the big reasons that scientists are looking towards it in the future, and this is discussed at length if you read, I mentioned this last week, but in the States, they put together the NBAC document, the National Bioethics Council on human cloning. One of the main reasons they want to do it is not, you know, to recreate, so that people can recreate themselves, but basically to create identical twins of people who, let's say, you have a one-year-old who has leukemia, right? This is one of the cases they bring up there, and the best donor to keep that child alive, right? It won't kill the other child, right? It'll just be a donor. Would be to create an identical twin, basically, and then take the, you know, bone marrow from the child. So there are medical reasons why one would clone. On the other hand, one of the ethical concerns that people raise is if you do that, what you're doing is you're creating a human being as a means to begin with, right? If our, you know, in the Kantian sense, right, human beings are morally important because they're an end in and of themselves, right? Aren't you undermining that by cloning them, right? Cloning somebody to create an identical twin who can act as his, you know, bone marrow donor. So that's one of the ethical concerns. But just to answer the question of why people are doing it, that's one of the big reasons that scientists are interested in it, or the government is interested in it, because of the life-saving capabilities for people who need donations. Yeah?
Until you explained this in the last 10 minutes, I had a complete misconception about cloning. I thought cloning was a photocopy. That's what I thought it was. This is a very clear explanation. I thought cloning was making another me, and another me make a million of me's, exactly like me, the same genetic.
Right, so, it is. It's the same genetic, it's an identical twin. Genetically, it'd be a 99% identical twin, yes.
It is reproducing me by means of an egg.
Correct.
As the vessel.
As the vessel, correct.
To carry
your
DNA.
We said there is this slight not yet understood science of what effect the mitochondria in the egg itself has on the identity of the child. At the moment, they will still have the same genetic makeup. We don't fully understand the effect of it. It seems to be there's a minor effect. We just don't know what it is yet. But it is exactly, that's what you're doing. You're creating a copy. You're creating an identical twin, right? Yeah.
But in addition to the DNA, don't you need sperm?
What? So we
you were explaining about the man who has no sperm or bad sperm.
Right. So we I The science a little bit eludes me in this one, whether we can fertilize the egg without it, or we use the but I think we don't, right? Or we don't need actual sperm, right? We can create the equivalent by right by the DNA, right? I mean, the point of the fertilizing is to add the other genetic components to it.
No, the DNA is being used to fertilize the egg.
Yeah.
There's no
if you take
from it's not classic fertilizing. It's
any place from your cell, your DNA, you've already been fertilized.
Yeah, I mean, you're fertilizing. Now there are, by the way, two types of DNA we can use. We can use sperm DNA, or we can use sperm DNA, or we could use DNA from the rest of the body. But yeah, we are fertilizing the egg directly with the DNA, right? Whether yes.
How it works is when you're a grown person, you have two sets of your chromosomes, and when you're a sperm or an egg, you have one set.
Right, and we're adding the second chromosomal side.
Right, it's applied to entirely.
Right, exactly. Right, I mean the egg. Right, we're clearing it out. Right, so I mean normally, right, the reason that a child is half genetically from his father and half from his mother is because half of it is provided by the egg, and half is created by the sperm. Here we're clearing everything out and putting a full DNA package into the egg. Right, and that has the equivalent of fertilizing an egg. Okay.
Is another question down there?
Yeah.
Somebody has a genetic disease, they can now modify the DNA.
Correct.
To take out, you've seen
more. Right, so that's another issue, is another possibility is that you could create a clone of, let's say, a dying child, but you know, a clone minus the disease, right? That's another possibility, another medical sort of possibility that has been raised. Yes, right? These are all right in it. I mean, there's a whole bunch of reasons, but that's another one that is raised. Okay. So, we've mentioned, for the most part, the issues of, is this too much like playing God? But cloning introduces a whole new set of issues, so I want to explore some of those issues with you. So, let's, for a moment, leave aside the playing God issue. Even though we all sort of see why with cloning this is an even more striking issue than the gender choosing, but it follows the same model, and you could see people saying that gender choosing is not playing God, but cloning is, but you still have people, as I noted in source one here from Dr. Steinberg, who still think it's not a problem, and we noted, even the Meiri, right, living 750 years ago, thought it wasn't a problem if one day we could create human beings. So what other ethical problems, though, do you think would exist with cloning, right? Based on what we've just described, what cloning is, at least at this stage in scientific history, right? What other ethical concerns, besides for playing God, are there? Yeah?
Development of another race.
Right. So one of the concerns is that you could create, you know, you might try to create, you know, Ubermen, or, right, again, eugenics, or create, right, the classic fear that you're going to create a million Hitlers or a million, you know, Gaddafis or whatever. For some reason, Hitler and Gaddafi always end up being the two examples in all the articles I've read. I'm not sure why. Yeah.
And also just changing the balance of numbers.
Right, right. Like we saw by gender choosing, right? It leads to the problems of choosing, right, a gender, right? It's similar issues. Yeah.
God's creation is that man is born and lives on the earth and has his number of 8, 4, 10, whatever, and goes to Olam Haba, whatever. And that isn't going to happen.
Right, so one of them is maybe this is a way of, you know, creating your legacy and making yourself immortal. But, right, but if we wanted to push back on that, right, if someone has an identical twin and they die and their identical twin lives, are they still alive? No, remember, what you're creating is your identical twin. You're not creating yourself. They don't have your life experiences. They're just genetically identical to you, just like your identical twin would be. Right? So, at first glance, it sounds like you're making yourself live forever, but in fact, what you're doing is you're making your identical twin live forever, or live beyond your death, right? And how different is that from having a child? Right? I'm just saying this is part of the push and pull. If you read the end back, right, you'll see that some ethicists say exactly what you said, is you're trying to live beyond yourself and you're trying to... And other people say, what do you mean? You're just creating your identical twin, right?
So the vessel is not the same as the life experiences.
Correct, right? They won't have your... Right? The same way that identical twins have the same genetic makeup but are not the same person, Right? Clones are not actually the same person. They're identical twins, essentially, or at least genetically.
Clones someday with the life.
If we can do that, that will be a totally different moral question. At the moment, that's not what we're talking about. Yes, if we could create, you know, 10 of me, right? Like literally 10 of me, right? Right now, so that, you know, I could personally, you know, go and give 10 lectures in different places, right? They all have my experiences, right? That would be a totally different, right? That would be a totally different ethical question of a different magnitude. But there are other issues, right?
Lack of genetic diversity.
Great. So if you want to see, for example, someone who said this, I'll go a little bit out of order, but just to, because you raise it. So if you skip already to source 9, and Rabbi Michael Broyd raises this possibility, that maybe there's another ethical problem, is maybe part of the reason that we value procreation is because it brings diversity in the world, into the world. And if you're going to actively clone, an identical twin happens by accident. So there's two of the same genetic makeup. But if you're going to actively engineer the world so that you have people without diversity, maybe that's a problem. Maybe God wants diversity. So Rav Meir ben Shlomo, I don't even know if this is his name correctly, is Avisahula. I'm not really quite sure. Right, Broyd mentions that it's quoted in a footnote, and then I found the original book. His name is Meir ben Shlomo Avisahula. He's two generations after Nachmanides. That's all I know about him. I can't find any other biography on him, which means he's somewhere in the 13th century in Barcelona. But he says, what is the reason for the prohibition of incest? So he writes, it seems that the reason for the prohibition of incest is that during the 6 days of creation, the spring produced branches, and after those 6, no new branches were made. All multiplicity comes from the branches. As an example of this, all relatives who are from one loin, one spring down or up, right, parents or children, etc., are prohibited to be with each other, right? That's the end of this passage, right? So he says, why is incest prohibited? He says, because God wants procreation to increase diversity in the world. And therefore, it's already too close if parents and children would be together, because then you would, right, decrease diversity. And genetically, we know that's true, right? Because if the parent and the child already share 50% of their genetic material, and then they were asleep together, the child, besides for having genetic disease, quite likely, would genetically be, right, much closer to the child and parent than a normal child to parent, right? A normal child gets 50% from one parent, 50% for the other. But here, if they already share, right, 50% of the genetic material, then the child is going to, right, the child of the father and child, or the father and daughter, let's say, would be weirdly muddled and too close to the parents, and diversity would be decreased. So, right, Broyd notes that based on this, one could make an argument that maybe one of the ethical problems is that the purpose of procreation is to increase diversity in the world. And actively creating identical twins or clones of yourself seems to be a problem because you are procreating without increasing diversity. So that's one ethical concern that's raised. What's another one? And this is the one that all the Christians are really, really, really upset about, right? I'm surprised no one said it yet, but and maybe it's less of a Jewish view, but the Christians write a lot about this in the NBAC, which is...
So you don't need two people.
Yeah, is the problem with this also is it undermines the process of procreation. And if you think there's sanctity in the act of procreation, in the notion that a child is born of two parents, then in a way you've really undermined that because technically, right... You are, there's a male and a female, so there's a male and female involved, but the child is not actually the product of a husband and a wife, of a couple.
But it undermines the virgin birth, if you can have a whole bunch more. The sanctity of the concept of the virgin birth.
Interesting. I haven't seen that one. It could be that there are people who think that is the case. But the other argument, for sure, people raise, and here, if you just look at sources 2, 3, 4, and 5, right, to see a Jewish someone weighing in on this. So, source 2 is just Genesis. Therefore, man shall leave his father and mother and cling to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And Rashi, the 11th century French commentary, says, what does it mean, and they shall become one flesh? The child is created by both of them, and there their flesh becomes one. The image of procreation in Genesis is that parents will join to create a child who is the union of both of them, not that you create yourself. And the Talmud, just one second, has a nice poetic way of describing it, and says there are three partners in a man: the Holy One, blessed be He, the Mother, and the Father. And you're undermining that here, because the only genetic person involved is whoever the donor parent is. And at least in the case of a woman, she could be the only one involved, because she could, right, put her full genetic data back in her own egg and reinsert it, and literally there would only be one person involved. So based on this, Eitan Fiorno, he's a doctor, who also wrote in this symposium in the Torah Umata Journal, wrote, cloning is a form of asexual reproduction. There is no union, no joining of two individuals or of their genetic information to create a new person. Cloning does not involve the union of two individuals. It is therefore not an act of creation, but rather one of duplication. And as such, is completely at odds with any Jewish understanding of conception. So, right, another ethical concern that he raises is that procreation is an expression of the sanctity of the marital act, which, you know, we as Jews believe in. Therefore, there are those who claim that this is an undermining of the sanctity of marriage, of the importance of procreation with a father and a mother. So that's one a second problem that people raise. Now, for those who are in favor of it, one of the things they point to is that the Talmud itself seems to have imagined the possibility of creating human beings without procreation, which would violate, you know, both of these principles, right? The sanctity of only having children through the act of procreation, and the importance of not acting like God. And this is in a striking and very difficult to understand passage in source 6. Rava stated, if they wish, the righteous ones could create a world. Rava created a man, a golem, and he sent it to Rabbi Zeira. Rabbi Zeira spoke with it, and it did not respond. Rabbi Zeira then stated, you are created by my colleague, return to your dust. Return to your dust, meaning die. Rav Hanina and Rav Oshia would sit every Friday night and study the Sefer Yetzirah, the book of creation, and create a calf that has reached a third of its potential development and subsequently eat it. So they point to this passage in the Talmud, which is hard to understand, but just to make the point that it seems like the Talmud is aware of the possibility of creating out of nothing human beings. And this seems to be even more extreme than cloning, right? You're creating it out of magic, out of white magic. I don't know exactly what this is. So don't you see that the Talmud is in favor of it? The problem is that this golem, whatever it's created, this, you know, humanoid, seems to not be treated by the Talmud as human. Witness the fact that Rabbi Zeira killed it. Right? He just spoke and it died. Again, I don't know what this means, but what it seems to, on the one hand, yes, it does seem to imply that the rabbis of the Talmud were okay with creating human beings. On the other hand, they weren't creating real human beings. Now, this passage therefore raises two issues, right? One is, would the Talmud actually support creating actual human beings? The second problem is, and no one raised this ethical concern, is there's another danger which people raise, is the clone going to be treated as a human? Right? There's the problem when you start eugenics, or when you start creating human beings, are we going to give human dignity to the child that is born? Because in the end of the day, genetically, the child that's born is a human being. But the danger is that he won't be treated as such. They ask, the rabbis even wonder, right? Well, wait a second. Would a clone be a human being? Or would a clone, in fact, be like this humanoid in the Talmud? And in fact, legitimately not be considered human, in which case cloning would be really bad because you're creating people that seem to be people but are not actually people who we're going to take advantage of, which is never a good thing. So if you look, this is just a summary because it's really complicated, but Chaim Jachter summarized some of the positions that are taken up, and this is in 7. At first glance, it would appear that the passage indicates that a clone is not human. Rava's golem was not considered human, as Rabbi Zerah killed it, and the Gemara does not record any objection to this action. Thus, one might be tempted to argue that since a clone is not a product of sexual reproduction, it is not human. Indeed, the Chacham Tzvi argues that Rava's golem was not considered human because it was not created in a woman's womb, which means if we ever got to the point where we could create a clone outside, at the moment we can't, so it would be human, but let's say we could create it outside of the womb, then wouldn't this clone who looks human not be human? Yes?
Even with a golem, as a golem, do they know that it's a golem? Does anybody know?
So, we'll see in a second, right? It's hard to build off these passages, but we'll see that they try. If you just continue this piece here, she said, this definition of humanity is problematic, as noted by the Radzina Rebbe, because it leads to the absurd conclusion that Adam Arishon, right, if you think that someone's only a human being if born from a mother, then the first human being, right, Adam, is not human, because he wasn't born, right? Accordingly, we must search for a different definition of humanity. The Marsha seems to say that the golem created by Rava was not human because of its inability to speak. This approach seems to be, or really to have intelligence. This approach seems rooted in Uncleus' translation of the verse, and man became a living being, which Uncleus translates, the Aramaic translator of the Torah, as man became a talking being. So, one of the ethical questions that's concerned is, first of all, is a clone going to be a human being? Well, at the current moment, probably, because it's born from a human. But what if we could create a test tube baby that would be born outside of human beings? Would that be our problem? Would be creating non-humans who seem like humans? So one of the questions people raise is, first of all, would the child be a human? And second of all, if yes, is there a danger that we'll treat it not like a human being? And if no, is there a problem of creating people who legally don't have the status of human being, but are in fact, right, look, think, breathe like other human beings? Now, certain people say that this is just a non-issue, because clones will be human beings. And if you look in Source 8, Rabbi J. David Bleich, who's a leading medical ethicist and halachic decisor, lives in New York. He's one of the Rosh Yeshiva in NYU. He has a very simple claim, and he says, yeah, a clone would be human. And he says as follows: the matter of identification as members of a species is best summed up in a pithy comment attributed to Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. It is reported that Reb Chaim explained a certain halakhic concept by posing the following query: why is a horse a horse? The answer is that a horse is a horse because his mother was of that species. For that reason, the Mishnah declares the offspring of a kosher animal is kosher, even if it has the appearance and physical attributes of a non-kosher animal, and conversely, the offspring of a non-kosher animal is non-kosher, even if it has the appearance and physical attributes of a kosher animal. Thus, identity as a member of a particular species is determined not by distinguishing characters, but by birth. Similarly, Rav Chanan Wasserman asserts that anything that is emitted by or proceeds from a particular entity has the status of the entity that produced it. Thus, there can be no question that, for example, a sheep cloned from a cell of another sheep and gestated within the womb of a ewe has the halachic status of a sheep. Similarly, a human cloned from the cell of another human and gestated within the womb of a human female is a human being. So Rabbi Bleich says, forget all these, you know, conversations. Is this child a human being? Are we going to treat it not like a human being? The answer is, it's a human being because it looks like a human being. It came from a human being. It's genetically a human being. It's born from a human. It's a human. And if it's a human, treat it like a human. We still have to wonder about the slippery slope. Are people not going to treat it as a human? Right, and that's an ethical problem that we have to be worried about. But the legal question he answers definitively: yes, the child is human. So let's just summarize because we're going to have to stop here. So now we've moved from gender choosing to cloning. We've noted that the first issue we have to deal with is the same we saw before, just in a more extreme form. Is there a problem of acting like God? The additional problems that we've seen are: does it undermine the act of procreation? There are those who think yes, and those who think that we're not too worried about it. Another possibility is that, as you mentioned before, it decreases the diversity that comes with procreation. Others think that's not a problem, and think that, you know, incest is prohibited for whatever reason it is, but not to teach us a general principle that we can only procreate when it increases diversity. And the next issue we dealt with is the legal question: is the clone going to be human? The answer seems to be yes, which leads to the still ethical concern we have to be worried about, which is, will people treat the human being as a human? And that is an open ethical question that we still have to be worried about. What we'll deal with next time is, just to deal with some of the other questions, is, okay, let's assume that it's permitted. Right? Let's assume that it's permitted. Does one fulfill procreation through the act of cloning? Or even if it's permitted, it's still not considered procreation. This is still not your child. So that's what we're going to do about. We're also going to touch on quickly, if you do this, who is considered the parent, the mother, the father? Are there, can there be multiple mothers and multiple fathers who start mixing genetic data? And we'll quickly run through them. And then we'll try to, probably in half of the next time, cover some of the basic issues with GMO.